The Guardian.
I'm Alok Jha, and this is Science Weekly for February the 25th. Coming up, we go beyond the hoax and discuss science, culture and philosophy with Alan Sokal. He was the controversial physicist at the centre of a scandal that rocked the scientific world more than a decade ago. Also in the show, we hear from the forensics expert who's investigating the conditions necessary for human heads to roll down hills. Whatever turns you on, I suppose. Speaking of which, doctors are claiming the G-spot really does exist, and we'll be giving you the evidence to prove it. All this, plus a song about Charles Darwin from anarcho-punksters Chumbawamba. This ain't local radio, mate. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Tribal. It's the third week of our excellent new music, and I hope you're boogieing to it as much as we are. To me, though, it sounds mysteriously close to a prog rock ballad from the 80s. I told you, and that is producer Ben singing, by the way. Anyway, we're a bit jet-lagged and scienced out following our trip to Boston and a subsequent ASS-cast, but that doesn't mean we're going to give you anything less than a serious pod this week. There's only one person in the studio with me today, and that duty's fallen to Guardian Science Daddy, Ian Sample. Ian, have you listened to the ASS-cast yet?
I have listened to the ASS-cast. I thought it was wonderful.
Did you like the ice cream bits most?
Especially the ice cream bit.
Excellent. But did you feel that you wanted to eat some of
that? I felt like I was there.
Too?
I felt jealous, actually, because I was here in London... Well, you guys weren't. There you go.
It was cold out there, if that's any consolation.
You poor things.
Okay, we'll start this week with a bit of a history lesson. In 1996, Alan Sokal, a professor of physics at New York University, wrote a paper for a cultural studies journal entitled Transgressing the Boundaries Towards a Transformative Hermeneutics of Quantum Gravity. It was published, reviewed and lauded, but Sokal soon confessed that the article was actually a hoax, designed to expose and parody the style of postmodernist criticisms of science. The incident became front-page news around the world and triggered a fierce and wide-ranging controversy known by many as the Science Wars. He's just written a book about the hoax 10 years on, and when he came into Guardian Towers, I asked him about its impact on his life and the wider scientific community.
There was a big debate in the first few years after 1996 when the hoax came out. And I think the result over the long term was that the postmodernists and extreme social constructivists backed off from some of their most extreme claims, which they realized they were unable to defend, and are now defending more modest claims with which one may still disagree, but at least are no longer so extreme. Now, I guess I and other like-minded critics of postmodernism can take some small credit for that. But I have to say, honestly, I think 90% of the credit has to be given to George Bush and his friends, who have shown where science bashing can lead in the real world. And one example is Bruno Latour, a prominent sociologist of science, who spent several decades stressing the so-called social construction of scientific facts, as he called it, and now laments the ammunition that he fears that he and his colleagues have given to the Republican right wing to allow them to obscure or deny the scientific consensus on issues like global warming, biological evolution, secondhand tobacco smoke, and so on.
That particular issue is something you raise in your new book as well, this idea that it's not science that you want to promote, it's the scientific worldview. Do you think that now, in the 21st century, the technological age, that we have enough of this? We have enough sort of respect for the scientific worldview?
Well, unfortunately not. That's I think, the main problem. Of course, we live in a world where the technological products of science are ubiquitous. But unfortunately, the scientific worldview, the scientific way of thinking, the evidence-based way of thinking, if you want to call it that, is very far from being even understood by the general public. And I think we scientists have to take a lot of the blame for that. We take for granted so much our way of thinking that we don't spend enough time explaining to the general public how we distinguish, for example, between real science and pseudoscience. We have some instinctive way of of doing this, but of course it's not just an instinct. There's a pattern, there's a method, but we need to take more time to try to explain this method to the general public.
I mean, one of your arguments is that 10 years ago you had various literary critics, essentially, or cultural critics, talking about science, and so they should. But still, scientists don't want to talk about anything apart from their speciality. Yet you're a physicist talking essentially about culture. Why do you think that's important for scientists to be getting involved in things like this?
Well, of course, we scientists tend to be cautious when stepping out of our own field because we know how easy it is to make a fool of ourselves. Even in a closely related subject, for example, a physicist talking about chemistry, much less talking about culture in general. But I think at least some of us scientists should try to explain to the general public as best we can more general issues about what is science, how do we do science, what good reasons are there for believing at least some of the results of science, and with how much of a grain of salt should we also take the results of science. For example, one thing that I want to stress that scientists, again, take for granted, but sometimes the general public doesn't realize and journalists often don't stress enough to their readers, is the distinction between well-tested science on the one hand, which is 90% right, and cutting-edge science, which is actually 90% wrong. There's a filtering process that science goes through to go from cutting-edge to well-tested. And of course, it's understandable the journalists will want to present cutting-edge science to their readers, but it's important to make clear that this may not be right. This has to be tested by other scientists. Experiments have to be replicated. They have to be redone in different ways. It may end up being wrong.
And it's okay to be wrong.
And it's okay to be wrong precisely because when a scientist does cutting-edge science, they're not claiming to be certain to be right. They're putting out a plausible conjecture which needs to be tested by other scientists. And then gradually through this filtering process, some fraction of that cutting-edge science becomes well-established science.
Alan Sokal there. You can hear that interview in full as this week's Science Extra. There's a half an hour of it, and Alan is really rather excellent, taking in everything from medicine to what's wrong with politics. Head back to iTunes or guardian.co.uk/science for more. And also watch out for a piece by Alan in The Guardian in the next few days. His book, Beyond the Hoax, is published by Oxford University Press, and it's out next week. I'm Alok Jha, and this is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Still to come...
The head as a spherical object is mainly the problem. It tends to roll down hills because it's much like a ball. It gets displaced the furthest from the body.
We hear from Gretchen Dabbs, the scientist who's investigating the conditions necessary for human heads to roll down hills. It's going to be epic. And an exclusive song about the life and times of Charles Darwin. That's all coming up, though. First, belt up and brace yourself for the trip-et around the rest of the science news that's been making headlines over the past 7 days. For one time only, I'm going to join Ian with the News Jam.
News Jam.
Doctors have boosted the immune systems of long-term HIV patients by injecting them with a growth hormone. This kick-started the thymus, a gland which often shuts down after HIV infection, and which plays a crucial role in the body's defences by producing T-cells, the workhorses of the immune system.
Major outbreaks of disease have become more common around the world in the past 40 years. Ebola and SARS, which originally spread from animals, are an increasing threat to human health. Many infections have now become resistant to antibiotics. That's according to an international team of scientists. They called for an early warning system to be set up in countries to spot outbreaks before they become unmanageable.
The FBI has developed sophisticated new software for reconstructing a person's face from their skull. The software is designed to help police identify partially decomposed or burned bodies and uses a library of CT scans of living individuals' faces to make facial reconstructions. At present, reconstructing a face from a skull takes a specialist artist up to 2 weeks and can cost more than £1,000.
Ultrasound scans revealed clear anatomical differences between women who said they experienced vaginal orgasms and a group of women who did not. The scans identified a region of thicker tissue where the G-spot was rumoured to be lurking. Now, other shows would have played you a clip of that scene from When Harry Met Sally, but not us. Ian, we'll come back to your G-spot in a mo. But let's talk about something a bit more serious first. HIV, how does this potential new treatment work?
Well, it's a very experimental theory, and it's based on a growth hormone. And the idea is that with a lot of HIV patients, as the immune cells are destroyed by the virus, obviously the virus infects the immune cells, it kills them off. And the thymus eventually shuts down, and it's the thymus that regenerates and produces these T cells. So these guys have used a growth hormone to kickstart and regenerate, essentially, the thymus, bring it back to life, and start to rebuild the immune system.
So does this mean a replacement for things like antiretrovirals rather than a vaccine?
Absolutely not, because the key thing about HIV is that the virus will infect the immune cells. So there's no point just producing more T cells, more immune cells, if they are just going to get more, if they're just going to get infected with the virus themselves. So what you need to do with this therapy is, first and foremost, you give people the antiretrovirals, you bring down the viral load in their bloodstream. Then what happens in some patients is, even though you can bring that viral load down, their T cells, their immune cells don't actually recover. So this is really for a section of the HIV community, which need those T cells boosting even once the virus is actually under control. And the hope is, even though these guys have yet to prove it, the hope is that by having more of those immune cells, they'll be able to combat better some of these just opportunistic infections that come along, TB, for example.
And pneumonia, for example, as well. I mean, it's good news, I suppose, because David Baltimore, who's the president of the AAAS, where we were last week, his opening address was all about HIV infections. He won his Nobel Prize for discovering the key mechanism of how the HIV virus works. And he sort of indicated that perhaps we're never going to find a vaccine for AIDS, for HIV, because it's such a ferociously complicated thing. So this is some good news about the treatments for that. Let's move on to another set of horrible diseases. Ebola and SARS are more common around the world than they were 40 years ago. Tell us more about that.
Well, this is an absolute disease fest. This is a group of researchers, an international group, including the Zoological Society of London, the Wildlife Trust, Columbia University. And what they did is they looked through records of emerging diseases around the world from 1940 to 2004, 64 years worth. And what they did is they looked for every case of an emerging disease, and then they produced a map which showed what sort of conditions you are really favourable to these new diseases coming out. And it's really the first decent snapshot we've got of where the threats are, if you like. And it brings up some interesting issues. It's probably unsurprising that the vast majority of these come from bacteria and viruses. More than half of them come from animals, certainly diseases we share with animals. And you just have to think about SARS and such like to see where animals come in, bird flu and such like.
H5N1, for example, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. But it also came up with an interesting idea that the next emerging diseases, the next HIV, the next SARS, could well come from the tropical regions. And these are places where we really don't have the infrastructure to look for these things emerging, because fairly poor countries, they just don't have the early warning systems. And it almost you see a lot of cases of emerging diseases detected in Europe and North America because we have the infrastructure to report them all the time. And what the researchers are saying, that there's probably an awful lot emerging from some of these countries, but it's just not reported. They don't have the kit.
What can you actually do with early warnings, though? Is it a case of containing them in the first place, or can you develop treatments more quickly?
It's going to be mostly about containment, and there's some level of this is saying that we need a global early warning system to protect all of ourselves. But I think there is a sense that some of the Western countries actually are worrying that the diseases will be upon them before they know it, and it won't be that a disease will emerge in some region and be contained straight away, which is what everybody wants. And so obviously the sooner a new disease is discovered, the sooner a treatment for it comes about as well. But I think the biggest issue is just containment, is stopping it spreading.
And how likely do you think it is? How realistic is it that we're going to have early warning systems in places like, China and the Far East, where things like bird flu first came from?
I mean, it's interesting because I was talking to scientists and I was saying, look, you've called for this before. You've called for early warning systems. And in science and in Nature, these two big journals, you get scientists now and again, they will write decent papers saying, look, we must do this and we should get together and get money out to these countries and take it on.
You need political will as well,
you need the political will. And as far as I could tell, nothing really has shifted on it. And so I think if it's moving, it's moving slowly.
I reckon it's got to be that lots of Westerners start dying and then it's going to be a vote winner. On to something a bit more positive, G-spots. Ian, I don't know how to ask this question, but where is the G-spot?
Well, I mean, I'm the last person to ask, really. But what's fascinating is this Italian doctor, Emanuele Giannini, had was paid to give ultrasound scans to about 20 women, half of whom had immensely enjoyable vaginal orgasms, the other half didn't. And he looked at the differences in their vaginal anatomy. And this is obviously in the sort of the cavity, let's call it. And he found that there was a lot thicker tissue between the vagina, the vaginal wall and the urethra in the women who had vaginal orgasms, suggesting that might be where a G-spot is, infused with blood vessels and the like and all that. And the women who didn't. And it's funny, it sort of plays on from some research he did a while ago. He's a kind of a G-spot meister. This isn't the first study he's done on G-spots. He found previously that this section of skin in women who have these sort of intense responses produce more markers, chemical markers of things, one of them being an enzyme that processes nitric oxide, which is by chance the same chemical that gives men erections.
So women can take Viagra as well, perhaps?
Women do take Viagra.
Yeah.
Apparently.
Well, because that stimulates the release of nitric oxide, doesn't it?
Is that why?
That's exactly why. That's exactly why men need it. Do men have G-spots? Do you know?
Well, I don't know, because what's intriguing about this story, and it's all, you know, completely enlightening for me, is that there are apparently for women two different types of orgasm. There's sort of clitoral orgasm and vaginal orgasm. What's, you know, some people say, well, this might not be a G-spot. It might just be an extension of the clitoris. It might just sort of, you know, go in a bit further than we thought on some women. Whether men have different varieties of orgasms, I don't know. How do we rank this? I mean, we need to sort of pull our thoughts and rank things.
No, I don't think that's a discussion.
We need a scientific study.
That's not a discussion for radio. It really isn't. And
you started it.
Well, I think we all need a cold shower and a lie down after that. If you want to have your say on any of these topics, post a comment on our Facebook wall or head to the science blog at blogs.guardian.co.uk/science. We ask ourselves a lot of questions on the Science Desk. One that Ian and I have never yet pondered, though, is this. Under what conditions will human heads roll down hills? More specifically, how steep does the slope have to be? We dispatched James Randerson to the American Academy of Forensic Sciences annual meeting in Washington to find out more.
My name is Gretchen Dabbs, and I'm a PhD candidate at the University of Arkansas in Arkansas, United States. And the title of my project is Predicting the Location of Scattered Human Remains, When Will Heads Roll and Where Will They Go?
Can you give us a bit of background as to, you know, why you would need to do this? You know, what sort of scenarios do you encounter where this sort of information is going to be useful?
In northwest Arkansas, we have the foothills of three different mountain ranges, which gives us a very hilly but not mountainous terrain. And we have the problem that our recovered human remains that the police bring to the Forensic Anthropology Center at the university tend to be incomplete. Often we get a crania or just some postcranial or, you know, body remains, and then a couple of weeks later or a couple of months later we get the opposite from the same area, which likely means that they were the same individual and body parts were removed or moved during the taphonomic process. So what I wanted to do is identify when these remains would become removed from their original deposition site. You know, when will the head roll down the hill?
And it's particularly the head that's the problem.
The head as a spherical object, or roughly spherical object, is mainly the problem. It tends to roll down hills because it's much like a ball. And so it gets displaced the furthest from the body, because, you know, carnivores do move body parts around as they consume the soft tissue, but it's not very far, and usually it's in a single localized area.
What did you do to look into this?
What I did is I obtained a donated cadaver from an individual who donated his body to science, and then I built an apparatus to mimic slope, to mimic a hill. And I basically put the head on the end of the apparatus and cranked the slope up using the jack from my car to increase the slope and measured when the head started rolling downhill. And what I found is that if the body is facing, or the head is facing uphill, it takes a lower slope to begin rolling downhill than if the face is facing downhill.
So uphill, the slope's got to be about 18 degrees, whereas if it's facing downhill, it's about 21 degrees, is that right?
Correct. And the reason for that is because facing downhill, the nose actually stops the forward progress of the head in its initial phases. When it's facing uphill, you get enough momentum going to just jump right over the nose by the time it gets around.
And what was the next part of the study?
The next part was to try the same process with crania, which is just the skull, okay, minus any soft tissue in the brain and all of that stuff. Unfortunately, that part didn't work, and so I moved on to the third phase, which was actually using this information on when skulls will roll to help us predict where the remains, the non-identified remains, will be when we find a crania or a body.
You mentioned before that you tried with the skull to do this, and that involved taking the tissue off the skull. How do you go about doing that?
There are several methods. What I use in my lab is called maceration, and it's basically a hot water bath with the we use Gain laundry detergent. It has enzymes in it that break down tissue, and then we put it over very low heat and just allow it to warm the water and activate those enzymes, which will break down the soft tissue. And then we use it, then we remove the tissue with bone scrapers and scalpels, and we just keep repeating that process until the bones are clean. And if you think about it, it's the same process that you can use when you make soup. You throw the carcass in the pot and you boil it off, and then the bones pop right out. And that's basically what we're doing, but at a very much reduced temperature.
So a bit like chicken soup. And why didn't it work? What was the problem when you tried that ad?
I have not actually determined why it didn't work. The crania itself was seated so well in the ground cover that I used to cover the apparatus that it just stayed in there, like nestled into the ground cover of leaves and twigs and branches and things, that it didn't go anywhere. When I introduced some energy, you know, through wind, you know, breath basically, I blew on it, then it started rolling right away. So it needs some outside energy, apparently.
Okay, and so the final goal is to be able to predict if you find either a head or a body without a head, where the other bits have come from or where they've gone. How far are you with being able to do that?
Well, right now I've developed a theoretical model based on both recovering the crania and the postcranial remains, where I use GIS software and readily available digital elevation data from the web, which was developed for the USGS, United States Geological Survey. And so I have the model, and I can predict where I believe these likely recovery areas are, and I am currently waiting to get a case, you know, a case where they found a crania and we're looking for the postcrania, or vice versa. So that's the stage I'm at. I'm kind of waiting right now.
And when that happens, if it happens soon, you'll be able to give investigators a kind of reduced search area to go and look in and say, according to my experiments, it must have come from up that hill there in this area.
Much less definitive than what you've said, but likely to have come from these areas is a better description. But yes, and that will greatly reduce the cost and man hours and, you know, recovery dogs and recovery team efforts, reduce the number of people required and things like that, which is the ultimate goal, really.
James Randerson there, speaking to Gretchen Dabbs. Don't go to either of their houses for dinner, ever. I think we'll move on from that delightful item, but if you're desperate to find out more about this thing, you can read more about the forensics conference at guardian.co.uk/science. After 52 minutes of pod last week, we're going to bow out in style a little earlier than usual. We've discussed the life and times of Charles Darwin an awful lot over the past month. Well, it has been his birthday. So we've decided to have a bit of a mini moratorium. But you know that we like a song on this show, so what better way to finish off this week than playing you a brand new track all about the granddaddy of evolution? It's by Chumbawamba, and it's from their new album, The Boy Bands Have Won. Now, I'm off for a few weeks, but let me leave you with the facts. Science Weekly is produced by Ben Green, I'm Alok Jha, and this is Charlie.
Spins the world from here to Asia Minor. In between the platypus and perfect Aphrodite, Charlie come with opposing thumb to question the Almighty. Over the river and over the sea, through holy storm and thunder, steer a course for a brave new world of common sense and wonder. See the dancing president, the congressman and teacher, jump into the music of the wealthy Midwest.
West preacher. Charlie, come with a brand new dance. Get on the floor and follow. Find yourself a partner and we'll swing into tomorrow. Over the river and over the sea, through hole and storm and thunder, steer a course for a brave new world of common sense and wonder. Truth, we're stepping out. Come join the worldwide party. Charge your glass and face the world. We'll drink a toast to Charlie. Over the river and over the sea, through holy storm and thunder, steer a course for a brave new world of common sense and wonder. Over the river and over the sea, through holy storm and thunder, steer a course for a brave new world of common sense and wonder. Over the river and over the sea, through holy storm and thunder, steer a course for a brave new world of common sense and wonder.
The Guardian.